Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday the 15th, 2024. I'm Riley Solzner from Drake University. Here is our first story. Today we're going to start with Iowa Legislature, Consequences Worry Retainers. There is a photo captioned, "Consumable hemp and other products for sale at Central Iowa Vapors in Des Moines on Tuesday, March 5th, 2024," by Nick Bowman, The Gazette. So the picture basically just has a bunch of vape products and hemp products in behind glass on shelves. It's very colorful. You have cans and gummies. Council Bluff lawmaker says hemp bill needed. Tom Barton, Lee Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. Iowa consumable hemp retailers warn legislation recently passed by the legislature that's waiting Governor Kim Reynolds' signature will have devastating consequences for the consumable hemp market in Iowa. Lawmakers earlier this month passed House File 2605 that would restrict the potency of hemp-derived products sold in Iowa and place several regulations on retainers. Under the bill, products would be limited to less than 4 milligrams of tetrahydrocannabinol concentrate. Let me spell that for you. TETRAHYDROCANNABINOL, better known as THC, per serving, and 10 milligrams per package. THC is the main active chemical in cannabis that causes a high. Consumable hemp products were legalized in the 2018 Federal Farm Bill and later the Iowa Hemp Act. The law allows for the sale of hemp products that contain less than 0.3 THC by weight. The laws were intended to address sales of non-intoxicating compounds like cannabidiol or CBD, but they also legalize the sale of hemp-derived THC products that have a similar psychoactive effect to traditional marijuana. Products containing THC sold at shops and bars generally range from 2.5 milligrams to 10 milligrams per serving, but some contain higher concentrations. The legislation would not only affect intoxicating products, but also those sold for therapeutic purposes. Rick Wagman owns HW CBD in West Des Moines. The business sells a variety of hemp products, including gummies, drinks, capsules, soft gels, oils, balms, lotions, and creams. Wagman asserts by lumping hemp-derived THC products with psychoactive effects under the same definition as non-intoxicating consumable hemp products, the bill effectively restricts access to safe legal products. It will make it next to impossible to provide our thousands of customers with the non-intoxicating legal consumable hemp products they have come to depend on for years now, Wagman says. Yes, we agreed there are loopholes that need to be fixed, but the language in this bill throws the baby out of the bathwater. It signed into law the regulations would not take effect July 1st. Reynolds' office did not respond to a request for comment Friday. Dawson, legislation desperately needed. In addition to imposing a THC cap on hemp products, the bill would ban the use and sale of any consumable product, including non-psychoactive CBD, to anyone under the age 21. This bill includes civil and criminal penalties for businesses that sell consumable hemp without first registering with the state. It would also allow the State Health and Human Services Department to confiscate non-compliant products from retailers. Synthetic THC would be banned, and retailers would need to attach a warning label to consume hemp products. Republican Senator Dan Dawson of Council Bluffs said during floor debate the bill was desperately needed to regulate the consumable hemp industry. Republican supporters of the bills have said they did not intend to legalize intoxicating products when they passed the Iowa Hemp Act in 2019. In the last 4 years, we would have seen the Iowa Hemp Act metastasize into something we expected and something we didn't expect, Dawson said. Now we are here today with a bill before us to try to put some desperately needed regulations on this industry. Dawson did not immediately respond to a request for comment Friday. Retailers, bill would block therapeutic products. Rebecca Ramker owns several CBD stores in Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and Quad Cities. Like Wagman, she is licensed by the state and sells a mix of full and broad spectrum CBD products. The former includes a small amount of THC. She said all products sold are third-party lab-tested and certified organic. Consumable hemp products naturally have trace amounts of THC that grow within the hemp plant, and while most of the products she sells have less than 4 milligrams of THC per serving, a traditional container which provides a 30-day supply of product contain 30 milligrams to 60 milligrams of THC on average, well above the 10 milligram cap included in legislation. That would bring it down to 4 to 5 gummies in a pack compared to 30 right now, Ramker said. Suppliers would not repackage their products, she said, making it difficult for retailers to find products that fit Iowa's law. That's going to make it more expensive for us and hit the pockets of customers, which is very sad, Ramker says. It's going to be costly. She estimated the legislation would affect 70% of the non-intoxicating products sold in her stores. She said the business serves about 800 customers a month of all ages who use the products for treating anxiety, depression, seizures, and difficulty sleeping, as well as for pain management. Industry supportive of sensible regulations. Ramker and Wagman agree guardrails are necessary to regulate THC intoxicating products, and age restrictions should be implemented to ensure responsible consumption. However, it's essential to recognize that many Iowan families rely on these products for their therapeutic benefits, and criminalizing access to these products would disproportionately harm these Iowans, Wagman said. Furthermore, both federal and state laws recognize the right of Iowans to access consumable hemp products safely and legally, he said. Rather than enacting sweeping measures that inadvertently restrict access to beneficial products, policymakers should focus on crafting targeted regulations that safeguard public health while preserving access to non-intoxicating hemp derivatives. Industry representatives argue that the approach ensures that consumers can continue to benefit from the therapeutic properties of hemp without undue restrictions. The problem is the people in Des Moines would not give us the opportunity to educate them, Ramker said. She, Wagman, and others in Iowa's hemp industry note Georgia recently passed a bipartisan hemp law by working with the industry to create sensible regulation. The Georgia law requires testing for hemp-infused edibles, drinks, and other consumable hemp products, and restrict their sales to those 21 years of age and older. The measure requires those that sell or manufacture hemp edibles, gummies, oils, and other products to obtain a license from the state, and state-licensed labs must test products to ensure the amount of THC, CBD, CBDA, and other cannabinoids, and ensure they are properly labeled, Axios reports. News story on hold. Wagman and Mike Thorson, owner of Don't Worry, Be Happy in Cedar Rapids, said the lack of definition between psychoactive and non-psychoactive products in the bill creates confusion and uncertainty among business and consumers alike, hindering growth of a burgeoning industry. Thorson says he has shelved plans to open a second store in Cedar Rapids because of uncertainty over how the legislation will impact Iowa's consumable hemp market. It makes it very hard for shop owners like myself or manufacturers to know what's going on, he says. Wagman said the state stands to lose tens of millions in tax revenue by forcing consumers in Iowa to go to neighboring states or online to get the non-intoxicating wellness products that are legal across the country. It's essential that the governor's office truly understands the impact of HF 2605 to ensure accurately reflects the intended scope of regulation without unfairly penalizing the consumable hemp market in Iowa. The next article is titled, Iowa Justice Recuses Himself After Affair Claims, by Caleb McCull, Lee Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. An Iowa Supreme Court justice recuses himself from a pending divorce case over claims he had an extramarital affair with the woman in the divorce more than a decade ago, according to court records. Iowa Supreme Court Justice Christopher McDonald granted an order to recuse himself in response to a motion filed by John Mordini, who was appealing the terms of a divorce proceeding with his ex-wife, Nikki Mordini. The case is in the Iowa Court of Appeals after John Mordini appealed the district court's decision on April 9th. In the motion asking for the recusal, which was filed the same day as the appeal, John Mordini stated McDonald and Nikki Mordini, an immigration and family law attorney, were involved in an affair during the time of the marriage. The affair had a significant negative impact on the marriage and ultimately contributed to the breakdown in the bonds of matrimony, the motion says. The motion further states that Nikki Mordini met with McDonald in the summer of 2023 after she filed for divorce and discussed the fact that John Mordini knew of the affair. It would be impossible for the appellant to believe he would be given fair consideration by Justice McDonald, given the aforementioned facts and events, the motion says. McDonald filed an order the same day granting the motion and recusing himself with no additional detail. Then, on April 11th, the justice filed an amended order. The amended order again granted the recusal motion and said the recusal was based upon a personal relationship between McDonald and Nikki Mordini that occurred more than a decade ago. Davis, a spokesperson for the Iowa Judicial Branch, said McDonald was unable to provide further comment. He said the Iowa Code of Justice Conduct prevents judges, justices, and court staff from commenting on pending cases. The Code of Judicial Conduct states that justices should recuse themselves when their impartiality might be reasonably questioned, including when the judge has a personal bias or prejudice concerning a party or a party's lawyer, among other circumstances. A lawyer representing Nikki Mordini declined to comment. John Mordini could not be reached by phone on Friday. The Polk County District Court granted the divorce between John and Nikki Mordini on March 22nd, about a year after Nikki Mordini initially filed for divorce. Nikki Mordini owns a law practice in Des Moines, and John Mordini is a self-employed in construction. They were married in 2003. Christopher McDonald was appointed to the Supreme Court by Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds in 2019. He served on the Court of Appeals from 2013 to 2019 and was a district court judge and in private practice before that. McDonald is married and has three children, according to the Iowa Supreme Court website. Court records show he was divorced in 2009. On to the next story. This article is called Analysis, All Sides Gained When Iran Attacked Israel, by Tia Goldenberg, Associated Press. TELAVIV, Israel. The unprecedented attack by Iran on Israel early Sunday ratcheted up regional tensions, confirming long-held fears about the Israel-Hamas war spiraling into a broader conflagration. But Iran, Israel, the United States, and Hamas also walked away with some gains. Here's a look at the fallout. Israel's response could restore faith in military. As the more than 300 drones and missiles headed toward Israel in the early hours of Sunday, the country was able to successfully put to the test its aerial defense array, which along with help from allies blocked 99% of the projectiles and prevented major damage. By contrast, Israel's military had suffered a bruising defeat at the hands of far less equipped enemy when Hamas stormed from Gaza into Israel on October 7th. That was a major blow to Israel's image as a regional military powerhouse and shattered any sense of invincibility. The response to Iran's attack could be what restores faith in the country's military, even as its forces are bogged down in Gaza more than 6 months after Israel declared war on Hamas there. Israel has also boasted about the coalition of forces that helped it repel the Iranian assault. It is a much-needed show of support at a time when Israel is isolated because of the concerns surrounding its conduct during the war against Hamas. Sunday's assault allowed Iran to show to its citizens that it won't stand by when its assets are attacked and that it was serious when it threatened revenge. With its strike, Iran was able to exhibit its fierce firepower, instill fear in some Israelis, and disrupt the lives of many through school cancellations. But with little damage actually caused in Israel, Iran might hope that any response will be measured. Several hours after it launched the drones and missiles, Iran said the operation was over. U.S. stood by Israel. The U.S. was a key player in repelling the assault, demonstrating to its allies around the world the power and reliability of American support. Now, as Israel mulls how and whether to respond, the alliance will be put to the test, with the Biden administration seeking to exert its leverage on Israel and prevent it from carrying out a response that might worsen the conflict. Hamas may benefit from Iran's direct involvement. Hamas, which is backed by Iran, welcomed the strike on Israel. Since launching its October 7th attack, Hamas had hoped the regional partners might come to its assistance and drag Israel into a broadening war. While some have done that, including the Iranian-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon and Yemen's Houthis, Iran had not directly entered the fray until Sunday. Hamas could hope that the attack is the first salvo in deeper Iranian engagement in the war in Gaza. He could also hope that violence in the West Bank, where an Israeli teen was killed and settlers rampaged in Palestinian towns, continues to heat up. At the very least, Iran's attack may have emboldened Hamas to dig its heels in current negotiations over a ceasefire, hoping the increased military pressure on Israel might lead it to accept the militant group's harder line terms for a deal. We are now in the nation and world section, and I'm going to read the digest. The first one is Russian attacks kill several civilians. Kyiv, spelled K-Y-I-V, Ukraine. More civilians died across Ukraine Sunday as analysis warned that delays in U.S. military assistance would see Kyiv struggle to fight off Russian offenses. One man was killed after a Russian drone hit the truck he was driving Sunday in the Sumy region, the local prosecutor's office said. Elsewhere, a 67-year-old woman was killed after shelling hit an apartment block in the Donetsk region, spelled D-O-N-E-T-S-K, said Governor Vadim Filashkin. Officials in the Kharkiv region, spelled K-H-A-R-K-I-V, also said Sunday that they had retrieved the bodies of a 61-year-old woman and a 68-year-old man killed by a Russian strike the previous day. Meanwhile, shelling in the Russian-occupied Kherson region, spelled K-H-E-R-S-O-N, killed two civilians Sunday, said Moscow-installed leader Vladimir Saldo. Next in this section, we have what's titled, Girl 8 Fatally Shot at Gathering in Chicago. Chicago. 11 people standing outside a family gathering Saturday night were shot, including a young girl who was killed in what Chicago police believe was gang-related violence on the city's south side. Four victims were children, police said Sunday. An 8-year-old girl was fatally shot, while a 1-year-old boy and an 8-year-old boy were each shot multiple times and listed in critical condition. A 9-year-old boy was also injured with a grazed wound to his finger and hospitalized. The department's Sunday statement updated the number of shooting victims to 11 from 8 and gave new ages for the victims compared with a news conference late Sunday. No one was in custody Sunday. Briefly, We have presidential debates. 12 news organizations on Sunday urged presumptive presidential nominees Joe Biden and Donald Trump to reach to debates, saying they were a rich tradition that has been part of every general election campaign since 1976. Oklahoma. Four people were arrested and charged with murder and kidnapping over the weekend in connection with the disappearances of two Kansas women who were driving through Oklahoma. Veronica Butler, 27, and Jillian Kelly, 39. Their vehicle was found abandoned on a rural highway in Oklahoma. Body parts. The wife of a former Harvard Medical School morgue manager, Denise Lodge, 64, of Goffstown, New Hampshire, pleaded guilty Friday to a federal charge after investigators said she shipped stolen human body parts to buyers. Moving on to the next article titled, Thousands Protest Abortion Rights. It has a photograph and it is captioned, Anti-Abortion Demonstrators March Against Steps Taken by the New Government to Liberalize Poland's Strict Law and Allow Termination of Pregnancy Until the 12th Week. It is a photo of a streetway with lots of buildings, and there is also a statue, and you can see many, many people marching. They have flags, and there are people taking pictures of them. New government seeks to liberalize strict laws governing pregnancy by Monica Sklizowska, Associated Press. Warsaw, Poland. Thousands of Polish opponents of the abortion rights marched Sunday in Warsaw to present recent steps by the new government to liberalize the predominantly Catholic nation's strict laws and allow termination of pregnancy until the 12th week. Many participants in the downtown march were pushing prams with children, while others were carrying white and red national flags or posters representing a fetus in the womb. Poland's Catholic Church called for Sunday to be a day of prayer in defense of conceived life and supported the march organized by an anti-abortion movement. In the face of promotion of abortion in recent months, the march will be a rare occasion to show our support for the protection of human life from conception to natural death, a federation of anti-abortion movements said in the statement. They were referring to an ongoing public debate surrounding the steps that the four-month-old governor of Prime Minister Donald Tusk is taking to relax the strict law brought in by its conservative predecessor. Last week, Poland's parliament, which is dominated by the Liberal and pro-European Union ruling coalition, voted to approve further detailed work on four proposals to lift the near ban on abortions. The procedure, which could take weeks or even months, is expected to be eventually rejected by Conservative President Andrzej Duda, spelled A-N-D-R-Z-E-J, Duda, spelled D-U-D-A, whose term runs for another year. Last month, Duda vetoed a draft law that would have made the morning after pill available over the counter from the age of 15. A nation of some 38 million, Poland is seeking ways to boost the birth rate, which is currently at some 1.2 per person, among the lowest in the European Union. Poland's society is aging and shrinking, facts that the previous right-wing government used among its arguments for toughening the abortion law. Currently, abortions are allowed only in cases of rape or incest or if the woman's life or health is at risk. According to the health ministry, 161 abortions were performed in Polish hospitals in 2022. However, abortion advocates estimate that some 120,000 women in Poland have abortions every year, mostly by secretly obtaining pills from abroad. Women attempt to abort themselves are not penalized, but anyone assisting them can face up to 3 years in prison. Reproductive rights advocates say the result is that doctors turn women away even in permitted cases for fear of legal consequences for themselves. One of the four proposals being processed in Parliament would decriminalize assisting a woman to have an abortion. Another one, put forth by a party whose leaders are openly Catholic, would keep a ban in most cases, but would allow abortions in cases of fetal defects, a right that was eliminated by a 2020 court ruling. The two others aim to permit abortion through the 12th week. The next article is called House Speaker to Push for National Security Package by Stephen Groves, Associated Press, Washington. House Speaker Mike Johnson said Sunday he will try to advance wartime aid for Israel this week as he attempts the difficult task of winning House approval for a national security package that includes funding for Ukraine and allies in Asia. Johnson, RLA, is already under immense political pressure from his fellow GOP lawmakers as he tries to stretch between the Republican Party's divided support for helping Kyiv defend itself from Moscow's invasion. The Republican speaker has sat for 2 months on a $95 billion supplemental package that would send support to the U.S. allies as well as provide humanitarian aid for civilians in Ukraine and Gaza and funding to replenish U.S. weapons provided to Taiwan. The unprecedented attack by Iran on Israel early Sunday further racketed up the pressure on Johnson, but also gave him an opportunity to underscore the urgency of approving the funding. Johnson told Fox News Channel's Sunday Morning Futures that he and the Republicans understand the necessity of standing with Israel, and he would try this week to advance the aid. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer at a news conference also said that President Biden held a phone call Sunday with the top Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate, including Johnson. The New York Democrat said there was a consensus among all the leaders that we had to help Israel and help Ukraine, and now hopefully we can work that out and get this done next week. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday the 15th, 2024. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap in Des Moines. I'm Riley Solzner from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Again, 515-243-6833. Are two obituaries for Saturday the 13th. Barbara Lindsay, September 20, 1935 to April 11, 2024. Barbara Jean Lindsay died after a brief illness on April 11, 2024 at home in Council Bluffs, surrounded by her husband of 45 years, Terry, and her 8 children, their spouses, and grandchildren. She was 88. She is survived by husband Terry, brother Joe, and sister Jean Schneiderwind, and children Joe, Simon, Bob, Simon, Carol Kelly, Michael Simon, Jerry Simon, Bernie Simon, Barbara Simon, Dan Simon, 20 grandchildren and 19 great-grandchildren. Barbara was preceded in death by her beloved parents Agnes Rose and W. James Schneiderwind, sisters Mary Ann Morris and Catherine Hibson, brother Jim Schneiderwind, and grandsons Cale and Dana. Nani was the sun and moon for her family and all in her orbit of warmth, big hugs, and lightning-quick wit. After raising children and retiring from nearly 20 years at Iowa School for the Deaf, Barbara devoted herself to the Council Bluffs community. In 2018, she and Terry were honored with the Mercy Heritage Award for Arts and Humanities, recognizing their No One Dies Alone program to be with patients in their final moments. Barbara also organized the book sale fundraiser for the Mercy Guild and would curate and buy titles for her children, grants, and teachers throughout the community. Barbara was a graduate of Leadership Council Bluffs, a 15-year volunteer for the American Red Cross, and instructor for the Community Emergency Response Team. preparing volunteers to respond to disasters and support community-wide celebrations, including the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa, also known as RAGBRAI. She was proud to have completed the longest RAGBRAI with her daughter Carol while in her 50s. Visitation is Monday, April 15, 2024, beginning 10 a.m., followed by service at 11 a.m. at Hoy Klonowski Funeral Home, spelled HOYKILNOSKI. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in Barbara's memory to the Mercy Hospital Foundation. The address of the funeral home is 1221 North 16th Street, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51507. Sharon Huz, spelled H-U-S-Z. Sharon Huz, age 79, of Carson, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. At CHI Health Bergen Mercy in Omaha, Nebraska. Survived by husband Curtis of Carson, son James Huz of Maryville, grandchildren John Reed, Jordan Huz, and Taylor Huz, two sisters and two brothers. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, April 15, 2024, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Trenor, Iowa. Visitation will be held Sunday, April 14, 2024, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Loess, spelled L-O-E-S-S, Hills Funeral Home in Carson. In lieu of flowers, the family will direct memorials. The address of that is 420 South Oak Street, Carson, Iowa, 5125. Moving into the sports section, golf, the Masters, Great Scotty, ... by Doug Ferguson, Associated Press, Augusta, Georgia. Scotty Scheffler spent more time looking at his feet than any of the white leaderboards at Augusta National, all of them showing what everyone was watching, a Masters champion again, the undisputed best player in golf. He prefers to stay in his own little world, population one. Nobody is close to him in the game at the moment. Scheffler is number one in the world by a margin not seen since Tiger Woods in his prime. In 9 tournaments this year, he doesn't have a round over par, and has earned over $15 million. And on Sunday, he delivered the greatest piece of evidence when he slipped into that green jacket. Scheffler pulled ahead with magnificent shots around the turn, poured it on along the back nine as his challengers melted away with mistakes, and closed with a 4-under-68 to claim his second Masters in 3 years with a 4-shot victory. Quoted, "I had a lot of really talented players trying to chase me down, and I knew pars weren't going to get it done," end quote, Scheffler said. Unlike 2 years ago when he won his first major, there were no doubts Sunday morning, no tears, and no wife to reassure him he was built for a moment like this. His wife, Meredith, was home in Dallas expecting their first child at the end of the month. Scheffler made sure there was no drama either. Much like Woods, he made the outcome look inevitable, with sublime control, the difference being a peach shirt instead of Sunday red, and no fist pumps until it was over. After sharing hugs with caddy Ted Scott and Colin Morikawa, Scheffler turned to face the crowd with both arms raised. "Woo!" he yelled, slamming his fist. Master newcomer Ludvig Amberg, among 4 players who had a share of the lead at one point, lost ground when his approach went into the pond left of the 11th hole, and he made a double bogey. Against a player like Scheffler, those mistakes are not easy to overcome. Amberg closed with a 69 and was a runner-up, not a bad result for someone playing in his first major championship. Morikawa, who had 2 double bogeys to fall out of the hunt, shot 74 and tied for third with Tommy Fleetwood, 69, and Max Homa, 73, whose hopes ended on the par 3, 12th, with a double bogey from the bushes, not Rays Creek. He is pretty amazing at letting things roll off his back and stepping up to very difficult golf shots and treating them like their own, Homa says about Scheffler. He's obviously a tremendous talent, but I think that is his superpower. Woods, meanwhile, closed with a 77 and finished in last place at 16 over 304, the highest 72-hole score of his career. This came 2 days after he set the Masters record for making his 24th consecutive cut. The 27-year-old Scheffler is the fourth youngest player to have two green jackets. He now has 3 victories against the strongest fields, Bay Hill, the Players' Championship, and the Masters, in his last 4 starts. The other was a runner-up finish in Houston. Scheffler finished at 11 under 277 and earned $3.6 million from the $20 million purse. Perhaps even more daunting for the rest of golf is that Scheffler now has 10 victories worldwide, dating to his first PGA Tour title at the Phoenix Open just 2 years and 2 months ago. During that stretch, Scheffler has finished in the top 10 a staggering 65% of the time. It was the 4th straight Masters when the winner came to the 18th green with one arm in the green jacket. That doesn't mean Sunday was a walk in the golf's most gorgeous garden. I felt like I was battling the whole week, Scheffler said. It was a long week. I had to battle some ups and downs. And you know, I'm very fortunate to be sitting here with you. 4 players had a share of the lead at various points along the front 9. And then Scheffler began to assert himself with 3 straight birdies around the turn. He got up and down with a 10-foot birdie putt at the par 5 8th. He hit the perfect wedge that caught the ridge and came inches within going in on number 9, leaving him a tap-in birdie. And then he holed another 10-foot birdie putt on the 10th to build a 2-lead shot. There is a picture of him, and it is captioned, Scotty Scheffler holds a trophy Sunday after winning the Masters at Augusta National Golf Club in Augusta, Georgia. The trophy looks like what I am assuming is a miniature version of the course's clubhouse. To read some of today's history. Today's highlight, on April 15, 1912, the British luxury liner RMS Titanic foundered in the North Atlantic off Newfoundland more than 2.5 hours after hitting an iceberg. 1,514 people died, while less than half as many survived. On this date, in 1965, President Abraham Lincoln died 9 hours after being shot the night before by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theater in Washington. Andrew Johnson became the nation's 17th president. In 1892, General Electric Co., formed by the merger of Edison Electric Company and other firms, was incorporated in Schenectady, New York. In 1945, during World War II, British and Canadian troops liberated the Nazi concentration camps, Bergen-Belsen. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who died on April 12th, was buried at the Roosevelt family home in Hyde Park, New York. In 1947, Jackie Robinson, baseball's first black major league player of the modern era, made his official debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers on opening day at Ebbets Field. The Dodgers defeated the Boston Braves 5-3. In 1955, Ray Kroc opened the first franchise McDonald's restaurant in Des Plaines, Illinois. In 1974, members of the Symbionese Liberation Army held up a branch of the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco. A member of the group was SLA kidnap victim Patricia Hearst, who by this time was going by the name Tanya. Hearst later said she'd been forced to participate. In 1989, 96 people died in a crush of soccer fans at Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield, England. Students in Beijing launched a series of pro-democracy protests. The demonstrations culminated in a government crackdown at Tiananmen Square. In 1998, Pol Pot, the notorious leader of the Khmer Rouge, died at age 72, evading prosecution for the death of 2 million Cambodians. In 2009, whipped up by conservative commentators and bloggers, tens of thousands of protesters staged tea parties, in quotes, around the country 3 months into the presidency of Barack Obama to tap into the collective angst stirred up by a bad economy, government spending, and bailouts. In 2012, passengers and crew of the cruise ship MS Balmoral said prayers at the spot in the North Atlantic where the Titanic sank 100 years earlier. In 2013, two bombs made from the pressure cookers exploded at the Boston Marathon finish line, killing two women and an 8-year-old boy and injuring more than 260. We will move on to lifestyles and entertainment. On gardening, Cobalt Verbena, Surprising Vigor by Norman Winter, Tribune News Service. It's planting season for many, and verbenas are high on the list. We had just fallen in love with Sabina Imperial Blue Verbena and piled on a bunch of awards, then, stop the presses, it has a new name, which is now Supervenia Cobalt. Not sure if this would be similar to Shakespeare's What's in a Name scenario, but one thing is for certain, it is even better than the garden guy thought. This year, a cold spell of a few nights had the garden guy moving containers to the garage. It was about 5 nights straight. Several of these containers had Supervenia Cobalt Verbena. There were 3 other containers of verbenas on the hillside that I did not move. All of them are now in a stage of rictitious bloom. Supervenia Cobalt is a crazy blue or violet blue. It is this color that has always driven photographers crazy. Sometimes it looks like its name suggests, the old-fashioned cobalt blue. Then there are times it looks more purple. Even the Proven Winters website has trouble nailing the color. There, it looks purple. But I can't fault that, because as I write this, looking out my sunroom's window, I see blooms of cobalt blue and purple, all on the same plant. One of my Facebook followers said it even seems to glow. This verbena, winner of top performer at the University of Georgia and the University of Florida, had a perfect score award at Michigan State University. In other words, from north to south. And rest assured, at your home too, you will have an award-winning blooming performance, bringing in butterflies and hummingbirds. The vigor will surprise you too. Proven Winners describes it as 6 to 12 inches tall with a spread up to 30 inches. As they mound together in a mixed container, don't be surprised to see blooms 2 feet high, maybe even taller, and some falling 2 feet over the rim. Supervenia Cobalt Verbena will need a lot of sun. The soil need not be luxurious, but as I always say, fertile and well-drained will be perfect. Tight, compacted clay that takes a pickaxe is hardly suitable. On the other hand, a large mixed container with a good light-weighted potting soil will give you the green thumb. I've been trialing verbenas for a long time, including old heirloom varieties, so know this. The handheld pruning shear is a friend of both you and the verbena. Cutting back to remove stressed woody shoots will stimulate new growth and more blooms and add years to your planting if you're in the right zones. I largely grow mine in mixed containers. This year, the Supervenia Cobalt Blue blooms have coincided with an uncountable number of yellow flowers from Lemon Coral Sedum. I've got partnerships with both the Super Bells Pomegranate Punch and Tangerine Punch Calibrancos, as well as Supertunia Mini Vista Scarlet Petunia. Since I am growing them in mixed containers and get watered most day, I feed every 2 to 3 weeks with a water-soluble mix. Those in the ground can be fed with controlled-release granules at planting with additional side dress applications about every 6 to 8 weeks. They are perennial in zones 8 and warmer, but considered outstanding value if grown as an annual. Look for the award-winning Supervenia Cobalt as you shop during planting season. There is a picture of them and it is captioned Super Vina Cobalt Verbena won awards from North to South, like top performer at University of Georgia and University of Florida, and perfect score at Michigan State. It will win in your garden, too. We also have entertainment briefs. This one is Jennifer Aniston still gets nervous on the red carpet. Jennifer Aniston still gets nervous on the red carpet. The 55-year-old actress shot to fame as Rachel Green in NBC sitcom Friends in the early 1990s and has gone on to achieve huge success in Hollywood, but admitted that all these years later, she is still not completely comfortable making public appearances. Asked if she still gets nervous, she told people, "Always, always, right now, literally in this chair." The Marley and Me star, who appeared alongside Courtney Cox, David Schwimmer, Lisa Kudrow, Matt LeBlanc, and the late Matthew Perry on Friends, recalled the early days performing her signature role and described it as a magical time. She said, "Oh, everything was the most exciting thing on the planet. It was just magic. Nothing was not exciting, and it's still exciting, but we've had more experiences. We've learned more lessons. There's a little more behind us." Aniston has been struggling to make it in Hollywood, until she had a chance meeting with television executive Warren Littlefield in a gas station who recommended her for the part in Friends. Now in the cartography section. Spheres of influence. Even in the age of Google Earth, people still buy globes. Here's why they're so alluring. By Lori Kelman. Find a globe in your local library or classroom and try this. Close the eyes, spin it, and drop a finger randomly on its curved, glossy surface. You're likely to pinpoint a spot in the water which covers 71% of the planet. Maybe you'll alight on a plane you've never heard of, on a place you've never heard of, or a spot that no longer exists after a war or because of climate change. Perhaps you'll feel inspired to find out who lives there and what it's like. Trace the path of totality April 8th solar eclipse took. Look carefully and you'll find the cartouche, the globe maker's signature, and the antipode of where you're standing right now. In the age of Google Earth, watches that triangulate, and cars with built-in GPS, there's something about a globe, a spherical representation of the world in miniature, that somehow endures. London globe maker Peter Bellerby thinks the human yearning to find our place in the cosmos has helped globes survive their original purpose, navigation and the internet. He says it's part of the reason he went into debt making a globe for his father's 80th birthday in 2008. The experience helped inspire his company, and 16 years later is keeping his team of about 24 artists, cartographers, and woodworkers employed. You don't go onto Google Earth to get inspired, Bellerby says in his airy studio, surrounded by dozens of globes in various languages and states of completion. A globe is very much something that connects you to the planet that we live on. Building a globe amid breakneck change. Beyond the existential and historical appeal, earthly matters such as cost and geopolitics hover over globe-making. Bellerby says his company has experience with customs officials in regions with disputed borders such as India, China, North Africa, and the Middle East. And there's a real question about whether globes, especially handmade orbs, remain relevant as more works of art and history for those who can afford them. They are, after all, snapshots of the past, of the way their patrons and makers saw the world at certain point in time. So they're inherently inaccurate representations of a planet in constant flux. Do globes play a relevant role in our time? If so, then in my opinion, this is due to their appearance as a three-dimensional body, the hard-to-control desire to turn them, and the attractiveness of their map image, says Jan Moore, Vice President of International Cornelli Society for the Study of Globes in Vienna. Perhaps a certain nostalgia effect also plays a role, just as old cars and mechanical watches still exert a certain attraction on people. How and how much? Bellerby's globes aren't cheap. They run from about $1,900 for the smallest to six figures for the 50-inch Churchill model. He makes about 600 orbs a year of varying size, framing, and ornamentation. Creating them is a complex process that starts with the construction of a sphere and progresses to the application of fragile petal-shaped panels called gores that are fitted together around the sphere's surface. Artists perch around Bellerby's London studio painstakingly blend and apply paint, dreamy cobalt and mint for the oceans, yellow greens and orcs for the landscape. The imagery painted on the globes run the gamut from constellations to mountains, sea creatures and dragons. Who buys a globe these days? Bellerby doesn't name clients, but he says they come from more socioeconomic levels than you think, from families to businesses and head of states. Private art collectors come calling, so do movie makers. Bellerby says in his book that the company made four globes for the 2011 movie Hugo. One globe can be seen in the 2023 movie Tetris, including one, a freestanding straight-leg Galileo model, which features prominently in a scene. And yes, some of the planet's wealthiest people buy them. A political minefield. There is no international standard for a correctly drawn Earth. Countries like people view the world differently, and some are highly sensitive about how their territory is depicted. To offend them with this incorrectly drawn borders on a globe is to risk impoundment of the orbs at customs. Globe making, Bellerby writes, is a political minefield. China doesn't recognize Taiwan as a country. Morocco doesn't recognize Western Sahara. India's northern border is disputed. Many Arab countries, such as Lebanon, don't acknowledge Israel. Bellerby says the company marks disputed borders as disputed. We cannot change or rewrite history. Speaking of history, here's the Earth apple. Scientists since antiquity, famously Plato and Aristotle, posited that the Earth is not flat but closer to a sphere. More precisely, it's a spheroid, bulging at the equator, squashed at the poles. No one knows when the first terrestrial globe was created, but the oldest known surviving one dates to 1492. No one in Europe knew of the existence of North or South America at the time. It's called the Erdafel, spelled Erdapfel, which translates to Earth apple or potato. The orb was made by German navigator and geographer Martin Behaim, who was working for the King of Portugal, according to the Whipple Museum in Cambridge. It contained more than just the cartographical information known then, but also details such as commodities overseas, marketplaces, and local trading protocols. It's also a record of a troubled time. The Behaim Global is today a central document of the European world conquest and the Atlantic slave trade. According to the German National Museum's webpage on the globe exhibited there. In the 15th century, the museum notes, Africa was not only to be circumnavigated in search of India, but also to be developed economically. The globe makes it clear how much the creation of our modern world was based on the violent appropriation of raw materials, the slave trade, and plantation farming, the museum notes, or the first stage of European subjection and division of the world. Multiple photos in this article. The first one is of a globe really close up, and someone has a paintbrush in their hand painting it. And it says, an artist paints a globe February 27th at the studio in London, Bellerby & Company. Globe makers in London has made thousands of bespoke globes up to 50 inches in diameter. Kin Chung Photos, Associated Press. Another photo is of a room filled with different shaped globes with different colors, and it says various sizes of globes are displayed February 27th at a studio in London. Another photo is of it's a blank sphere, and you can see two hands putting a wrapping on the sphere that gives it its globe geography. And the one next to it is of a woman painting a globe, but this one is shaped more like an egg, and she is in an art studio. And it is also says an artist makes a globe February 27th at a studio in London. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, the 15th, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each week at 5 p.m. I'm Riley Solzner from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.